I'm Victor Beatty. UN rights experts have condemned Saudi-led coalition airstrikes in Yemen for causing heavy civilian casualties that may amount to war crimes. Charles Garraway is a member of that team.
If the removal in the targeting process of the protections built in and designed to protect civilians, if the removal of those protections is such as to effectively undermine international humanitarian law, then yes, they may arise to violations of international humanitarian law, and in certain cases, provided the necessary intent is there, to war crimes as well.
One strike earlier this month targeted a fish market in Hodeida that killed dozens. The panel criticized the Houthi rebels for firing missiles into Saudi Arabia, shelling the city of Taiz, committing torture and using child soldiers. U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis, when asked about the report, insisted the U.S. role in providing training and intelligence to Saudi-led forces is aimed at reducing civilian casualties.
Our conduct there is to try to keep the human cost of innocents being killed accidentally to the absolute minimum. That is our goal where we engage with the coalition.
Mattis said the U.S. wants to bring the warring parties to the negotiating table. British Prime Minister Theresa May in South Africa Tuesday pledged to make her country the largest investor in Africa.
The UK is one of South Africa's largest trading partners, with our trade worth over £9 billion last year. And we've agreed that as the UK prepares to leave the EU, we must think about how to grow that trade in the future.
Ms. May announced the British government would invest more than $5 billion in African economies. Ghana says it signed a $20 million trade and investment deal with Britain. The Prime Minister touring South Africa, Nigeria, Kenya, as her government negotiates a Brexit divorce. This is VOA News. The U.S. and Canada will enter into detailed trade talks Wednesday after the U.S. and Mexico announced a breakthrough agreement Monday to replace the 24-year-old North American Free Trade Agreement. Chrystia Freeland, Canada's foreign affairs minister, met Tuesday in Washington with the U.S. trade representative.
It was a very constructive meeting with Ambassador Lighthizer and his team, and we'll be back again tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock to continue the discussion.
Freeland said the breakthrough between the U.S. and Mexico clears the way for what she called significant, substantive, and productive conversations. But Prime Minister Justin Trudeau cautioned his government would only sign a trade deal if it's good for Ottawa.
We're in the process of renegotiating NAFTA with our southern neighbors, and we're pushing hard to conclude an agreement that is win-win-win.
Canada said it intends to protect its dairy industry with a regime of high tariffs on imports. Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu announced Tuesday the biggest war games held by his country since the end of the Cold War, scheduled next month, including almost 300,000 troops and 1,000 aircraft. The exercises will include forces from China and Mongolia. UN Syria envoy Stephanie Mistura has invited several countries for talks in Geneva next month to discuss the way ahead on a political process. Meanwhile, there's growing concern about the fate of civilians in rebel-held Idlib province as Damascus prepares an assault. John Ging is with the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs.
Recent weeks have seen a further serious deterioration of the humanitarian situation in the northwest, with intense aerial bombardment and shelling reported in parts of Idlib, Aleppo, Hama, and Latakia governorates, resulting in the death and injury of civilians and the damage and destruction of civilian infrastructure, including schools, hospitals, placing even more strain on humanitarian responders and vulnerable host communities.
Russia Tuesday accused rebels of preparing a chemical attack, while senior U.S. officials warned both Russia and Syria against using chemical weapons in Idlib. Iran's parliament was unconvinced by answers provided by President Hassan Rouhani about the ailing economy. His testimony came in the face of reimposed U.S. sanctions after Washington pulled out of the 2015 nuclear agreement. A homemade bomb hidden under a motorcycle killed two and wounded dozens at a local street festival in the southern Philippines Tuesday. There was no media claim of responsibility. Nigeria is investigating the authenticity of an audio recording of a teenage girl abducted last February pleading for help. Leah Sharabu was among 100 girls abducted by Boko Haram insurgents from a school in Dapchi in Yobe State. U.S. consumer confidence hit an 18-year high in August with a strong labor market and consumer spending. I'm Victor Beatty, VOA News.
Morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butt in Washington. Today's Wednesday, August 29th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. Kenya's Deputy Chief Justice has been arrested for alleged corruption.
The evidence in our possession reveals that Lady Justice Mwilu abused her office for personal gain, accepted a gift in the form of money in circumstances which undermined public confidence in the integrity of her office.
Noordin Hajin is Kenya's Director of Public Prosecution. South Sudan's rebel leader refuses to sign the latest peace deal. Zimbabwe opposition leader Nelson Chamisa accuses the court of complicity in President Mnangagwa's election victory. And Liberia's House of Representatives passes a bill to impeach a Supreme Court Associate Justice.
His Honor Kabina Jane is suspended from the office of Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, but shall receive any salaries, benefits, or emoluments appertaining.
Mildred Sayons, Chief Clerk of Liberia's House of Representatives. South Africa's Parliament withdraws a controversial land expropriation bill, and a voice recording has surfaced allegedly of one of the kidnapped Dapchi girls of Nigeria. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Kenya's Deputy Chief Justice, Philomena Mwilu, was arrested Tuesday at the Supreme Court in Nairobi on corruption allegations. Director of Public Prosecution Noordin Hajin says the arrest was carried out with the consent of Chief Justice David Maraga. Justice Mwilu was released on a $50,000 bond. She's expected to appear in court today, Wednesday, to answer to the charges against her. Maureen Ojiambo reports from Nairobi.
The arrest of Justice Mwilu followed immediately after she had attended a series of meetings by the Judicial Service Commission. It was not immediately clear if she had been grilled by her employer during these meetings. The meetings were held before Justice Mwilu was taken into custody and were attended by Public Prosecution Haji and the Director of Criminal Investigation, George Kinoti. During a press conference, Haji said Philomena was found guilty of abuse of office, tax evasion, and contribution towards the collapse of the Imperial Bank of Kenya, which is currently under receivership.
There can be no justice if lawyers, prosecutors, magistrates, judges, and investigators who are court officials use their position to enrich themselves at the expense of the Kenyan people. The evidence in our possession reveals that Lady Justice Mwilu abused her office for personal gain, accepted a gift in the form of money in circumstances which undermined public confidence in the integrity of her office, obtaining execution of a security belonging to Imperial Bank Limited, now in receivership by false pretense, unlawful failure to pay taxes, conducted herself in disregard of the law. In view of the above, I have concluded that the evidence is sufficient with a reasonable prospect of conviction.
Mr. Haji promised swift action against all lawbreakers and that corrupt individuals holding high-profile public offices will face charges without favor of their positions.
This chaotic system needs to come to an end for the sake of our people. We as prosecutors are doing our best to support that vision. We have embraced our role in prosecuting crime, in turn protecting Kenya's civil liberties. We are prioritizing and being strategic in our actions so as to achieve the maximum possible impact in the shortest period. In the fullness of time, wherever there are lawbreakers, we will be there to take them to court and ensure that they are punished.
During Tuesday evening's court hearing, Magistrate Lawrence Mugambi released Mwilu on a cash bail of $50,000 with a surety that she'll report to court today, Wednesday, without failure.
Consequently, the court orders that pending any further proceedings that will continue tomorrow, each accused shall be released on executing a personal bond of Kenya shillings 5 million. They are further ordered to appear before this court tomorrow without fail at 9 a.m. These terms are temporary to secure their appearance tomorrow.
The allegations put Justice Mwilu's position at stake and taint the image of the Supreme Court. Lawyer George Gidi says Mwilu is at risk of losing her position as Deputy Chief Justice, even if the accusations against her are backdated before she acquired the title.
I think her job is at stake on account of the fact that office she occupies with such accusations do not instill confidence in her to continue on the job. So matters of office insulation, let's say for without doubt that it affects the integrity of the office. She cannot then continue to act in the office. Her continued occupation of the office is therefore compromised.
Mwilu has not been cooperative with the current regime, given that she ruled against President Uhuru Kenyatta Kenyatta during last year's general election. And now Kenyans are alleging that President Kenyatta's sentiments of revisiting the court ruling is in action. Justice Mwilu has not been able to say anything about the allegations against her, but the arrest of such a high-ranking judicial staff is unique in Kenya's history and likely to send shockwave throughout the judiciary. Reporting for VOA's Daybreak Africa, I am Maureen Ojembo in Nairobi, Kenya.
Liberia's House of Representatives Tuesday passed a bill to impeach Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Kabina Jane. The bill has been sent to the Senate, which has the constitutional responsibility to hear the case and convict or acquit Associate Justice Jane. As Moses Garcia will report from Monrovia, Justice Jane is accused of undermining the integrity of the Supreme Court in his personal interest.
His Honor Kabina Jane is suspended from the office of Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, but shall receive any salaries, benefits, or emoluments appertaining to the same.
That was Mildred Sayan, Chief Clerk of the House of Representatives, reading the bill of impeachment and recommendations from a special committee which considered the petition to impeach Associate Justice Kabina Jane brought by Representative Akaris Gray and Thomas Fala of the ruling Coalition for Democratic Change. Following the reading, House Speaker Buffer Chambers requested a motion for a vote to be taken on the bill of impeachment with 49 out of the 72 lawmakers present in session.
It has been moved and seconded that the reports being proffered be endorsed, the motion for the process be herewith approved by this body to be sent to the Senate. With that, are you ready to vote?
I'm ready.
As per Rule 19, a roll call was done. As per Rule 19, there was a roll call leading to this day. Thank you, Richard.
There was, however, serious confrontation before the votes was taken. All 9 representatives from Nimba County, a county where Justice Jane hails from, walked out of the chambers in protest. Here is one of the protesting lawmakers, Larry Nyokwe, explaining why he was leaving the proceedings.
To me, I feel that it's a travesty of justice, and the only way to do, since we don't have the number, is to give them a chance until that item is over there. The fact is that a motion was made for a vote on this very critical issue to be taken on a year and year basis, and there's no room for anybody to independently show how he or she voted so the public will know. So as it stands, we cannot be vindicated.
The petition to impeach was brought by Representative Gray and Fala. It accuses Justice Jane of alleged official misconduct, abuse of office, wanton abuse of judicial discretion for private gains, misuse of power, fraud, and corruption. The 2 lawmakers accused Justice Jane of aiding and abetting lawyers representing Ecobank to ignore all procedures or a negotiated settlement in the case involving one Austin Clark to file a petition for a writ of certiorari. The bill is expected to be forwarded to the Liberian Senate, which has the constitutional responsibility to execute impeachment proceedings on justices of the Supreme Court. With no bill of exception filed from the floor on Tuesday, Justice Jane is now expected to face the Senate for his impeachment. If found guilty, 2/3 of the total membership of the Senate will have to agree before he is impeached. Meanwhile, legal pundits have labeled the impeachment proceeding of Justice Jane as a payback for his dissent opinion delivered during the final verdict of the landmark election case during the 2017 presidential elections. Majority justices ruled that there was no enough evidence of alleged foul play in the first round of the 2017 presidential elections, as was alleged by Councillor Charles Bromskin of the Liberty Party, who opted for a rerun. Justice Jane disagreed with his colleagues and instead called for a rerun in his dissent opinion. Moses Gazio, VOA Daybreak Africa, Monrovia, Liberia.
Today's Wednesday, August 29th, and you're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is now 14 minutes past the hour. South Sudan rebel leader Riek Machar and other opposition party leaders have refused to sign the latest draft of a revitalized peace deal to end a 5-year civil war. Machar and President Salva Kiir signed a ceasefire and power-sharing deal last month in Khartoum, but they put off making a decision on the contentious issue of the number of states and their boundaries. Michael Atit reports from Sudan's capital, Khartoum.
Despite the SPLM-IO and other opposition parties' refusal to sign, delegates of the Kiir administration and other parties did sign the latest agreement in Khartoum. Speaking at the signing ceremony, Sudanese Foreign Minister Al-Dirudiri Mohamed Ahmed says mediators engage all parties, all of whom did reach agreement on several other issues.
We agreed on the issue of the five ministries that are supposed to be created anew, as we have enlarged the cabinet of South Sudan from 30 to 35. Additionally, we have agreed on the sharing of powers and competencies within the presidency.
Lama Kol, head of the National Democratic Movement, a member of the opposition alliance, says since the warring parties have not agreed on the number of states and their borders, he sees no point in signing an incomplete deal.
This summary was necessary to harmonize the two provisions under the same article. That is the main concern of that summary. Second, it also outlines some guidelines for the IBC, the committee which is entrusted with deciding on the number and boundaries of the states.
Parties also did not agree on the criteria for selecting ministries during the transitional period. In addition, the warring parties did not agree on what constitute a two-third majority during the Council of Ministers meeting or during voting in the National Assembly during the transitional period. SPLM-IO delegate Stephen Jalpal says his group insisted that the signed document should include suggestions on how to resolve the dispute over the number of states and their boundaries, which he says would provide a clear choice for the citizens should an independent boundaries commission fail to resolve the issue.
We should not just go with the 32 states as they are. And we need to have it as a multiple choice of 32, 10, and 21 states. And we want to start with the demarcation process.
Foreign Minister Ahmed says those suggestions are not included in the agreement and should be handed over to IGAD as a separate paper for further consideration.
Our understanding is that that text is not part of the agreement. It will be handed to the IGAD summit, and the IGAD summit will decide whether to include it or not.
Michael McQuay, who represents the government at the talks, is calling on the SPLM-IO and the opposition alliance to reconsider their decision.
We have been following all that was happening, and if anything happens like this, it will not be strange to us. But what I know is that at the end of the day, people will come to their senses and join the peace process.
Both Akol and Pal assure the South Sudanese people that the opposition will work with the mediators and the government to bring lasting peace to South Sudan. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Khartoum, Sudan.
The leader of Zimbabwe's opposition MDC alliance, Nelson Chamisa, says he is not backing down from his allegations that the ruling ZANU-PF party stole the July 30th elections and that the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission and the Constitutional Court were all complicit in facilitating President Mnangagwa's victory. Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe Service reports on the opposition leader's plans for the future.
Despite a constitutional ruling that paved the way for President Emmerson Mnangagwa's inauguration Sunday, the opposition party's leader, Nelson Chamisa, said the bigger issue of legitimacy still hangs in the balance.
The issues of legitimacy are not resolved in the court. Legitimacy comes from the people, and the people have decided, the people have spoken, the people have voted. Their voice must be protected. It would be of no use for people to go and vote if their vote does not count.
Having failed to get a favorable ruling from the Constitutional Court in Zimbabwe, whose ruling is final, Chamisa, who did not attend Sunday's inauguration, is now looking outside Zimbabwe to help shed light on what he insists was a stolen election. His party, which has been engaging diplomats of various Western and regional countries, plans to take its case to the African Commission on Human and People's Rights in the Gambia, though he knows it will have no bearing on Mnangagwa's presidency.
Yes, that route is crossed, but we have other remedies available for purposes of testing the correctness of the decision, for purposes of laying to bed and on the table the evidentiary basis upon which we're seeking the relief we're seeking the Constitutional Court. We must also exploit and explore our remedies that are available on the continent, because we need African solutions to African problems.
President Mnangagwa has called out to Chamisa directly to join him in his call for peace, but Chamisa said outside Twitter and in public speeches, Mnangagwa has not officially reached out to him.
There hasn't been any approach, there hasn't been any indication of that kind of invitation.
Chamisa contends that previous efforts to engage Mnangagwa in dialogue prior to the elections have not succeeded in getting them to meet.
We wrote to Mr. Mnangagwa on a party-to-party basis, but also in his capacity as the government leader, then before elections, because we addressed certain issues. Those issues have not been addressed. The letter has not been responded to. We would expect a reply from him. Then we can start to talk about how to go forward. Because if he doesn't do that, we will continue to insist on our position that we won this election.
However, some members of the ruling ZANU-PF party say there is no basis for Mnangagwa to meet with Chamisa, particularly following the Constitutional Court ruling, which was aired live on TV and Facebook and gave Mnangagwa the mandate to lead. The party secretary for legal affairs, Paul Mangwana, said Chamisa has no leverage to make any demands.
Nelson Chamisa is clearly aware that he lost the elections with a very good margin of almost 300,000 votes. So he has no basis for wasting everybody's time. Instead of allowing President Mnangagwa to focus on governing the country and bringing economic recovery to the people of Zimbabwe.
Chamisa says he and his party only want the best for Zimbabweans who for years have been living under a shattered economy and isolation from the international community and will keep up the pressure on Mnangagwa to do what he says he would have been able to do in a short time. Reporting for VOA Zimbabwe Service, I am Blessing Zulu in Washington.
The leader of South Africa's Black First, Land First movement says he welcomes Parliament's decision Tuesday to withdraw the controversial land expropriation bill passed 2 years ago. The bill compels the government to buy land from white owners to compensate for racial disparities in ownership during the apartheid era. The ruling African National Congress has proposed to change the constitution to make possible the expropriation of land without compensation. Andile Mtama, president of the Black First Land First Movement, says the original bill did not take into consideration that land in South Africa was stolen by whites and therefore blacks should not have to pay to get it back.
The withdrawal of this bill has nothing to do really with the big moment in South Africa right now where our people say they want land back and there's a parliamentary process which is supposed to make this real. This bill is old. It was there long before the resolution for land expropriation without compensation, which was taken sometime this year. That resolution will go to Parliament, ostensibly to make it into a new bill for land expropriation without compensation. What does worry us, though, as Black First Land First, is that this is going to delay the process of amending the Constitution.
Let me understand. The bill that has been now withdrawn by the African National Congress had made it mandatory for the government to compensate people whose land had been expropriated. Is that correct?
That's correct. That is why when that bill went before the former president, Mr. Jacob Zuma, we as Black First Land First wrote to him to ask him not to sign it into law because it does not address how land must return to black people. It says we must still buy back the land stolen from us. And we said, no, we can't do that. We want the land returned without paying a cent.
The land issue in South Africa took on an international flavor last week or so when U.S. President Donald Trump tweeted about the land issue in South Africa. And so I was reading an article on Tuesday where President Ramaphosa is telling the President of the United States to take care of the United States, and he, Ramaphosa, and South Africans will take care of South Africa. What's your view on this whole issue?
We know for a fact that when land is taken and returned to its rightful owners, the white world globally is going to respond with punitive measures, just like they did in Zimbabwe. Now, the white people in this country are worried about this momentum for land return, have been going around, including the U.S., saying that there's genocide against them in South Africa and their land has been taken. So Donald Trump is, in a sense, responding to this. There is no genocide at all. It's a lie used to try to get global sympathy from white people so that there is pressure put on the South African government that land does not return to its people. Now, President Ramaphosa, incidentally, is a man of the West. Also, this becomes rhetorical games where he says, no, Trump must take care of the U.S. In fact, we believe he's part of trying to radicalize, to make Ramaphosa look like he's radical for the purpose of elections, not to solve this problem. So we don't take Ramaphosa's response seriously because in any event, he works very closely with the American system and his whole economic system is based on that. And we are saying Ramaphosa is not serious about land expropriation. It is not going to happen.
Andile Mtama is president of the Black First, Land First Movement of South Africa. You're speaking with me from Johannesburg. A Nigerian news company released an alleged proof of live audio recording on Monday night of Leah Sharibu, one of the 100 so-called Dapchi girls abducted in February by Boko Haram militants. Insurgents released other classmates but continued to hold Sharibu captive, reportedly because she refused to convert from Christianity to Islam. Her parents and activists have stepped up calls for government action to free her. Chika Odua reports from Maiduguri in northeastern Nigeria.
The parents of Leah Sharibu, a Nigerian high school student kidnapped by Boko Haram in February, have since then had no idea if their daughter was still alive. But now, they may have finally heard her voice. I am Leah Sharibu, the voice says. I was kidnapped from Dapchi school, and I am begging the Nigerian government to have pity on me, it says. The audio, along with a photo of Sharibu in captivity, were released on Monday night by Nigerian online news outlet The Cable. Nathaniel Sharibu, Leah's father, says the voice is indeed his daughter's.
Yes, it's her. She is the one. Yes, I feel very, very encouraged yesterday as I hear her voice. I believe now that my daughter is still alive.
In the 35-second audio clip, the voice, alleged to be Sharibu, asks for the Nigerian government to help her family. They have been having a hard time in the months since Boko Haram abducted her, along with over 100 of her classmates. While the insurgents released her classmates, Sharibu remains in captivity, reportedly because she refused to convert to Islam. The Free Leah Sharibu hashtag and the audio recording have been trending on Nigeria's social media. Nigerian activist Rebecca Gadzama says the proof of life audio is an answered prayer.
I knew it will come up one day. I had the confidence in me that the government wants it to bring this girl back. So I've all along been positive.
The Nigerian government did not immediately confirm the audio's authenticity. A spokesman for President Muhammadu Buhari said they were investigating the audio and would soon release a statement. The Bring Back Our Girls movement, which launched after Boko Haram's 2014 abduction of the Chibok schoolgirls, vowed to increase pressure on the government to free Sharibu.
Chika Odua for VOA News, Maiduguri.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. Kenya's Deputy Chief Justice, Philomena Mwilu, was arrested Tuesday at the Supreme Court in Nairobi on corruption allegations. Justice Mwilu was released on $50,000 bond. She's expected to appear in court today, Wednesday, to answer to the charges against her. And Liberia's House of Representatives Tuesday passed a bill to impeach Associate Justice of the Supreme Court, Kabina Jane. The bill has been sent to the Senate, which has the constitutional responsibility to hear the case and convict or acquit Associate Justice Jane. That's it for this Wednesday, August 29th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with our engineer Greg Burns, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing all of you in Africa a very, very good day.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, pressure mounts on Ugandan President Yoweri Museveni over the beating and detention of music star Bobby Wine. And we'll discuss the legacy of Kofi Annan on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
come celebrate the 60th birthday of legendary King of Pop, Michael Jackson, on Wednesday, August 29th, with a very special edition of Border Crossings. Join Larry London as he takes you back through time with a full hour of Michael Jackson's greatest hits. With a career spanning over 40 years, Michael Jackson gave us plenty of songs to choose from. Don't miss Border Crossings on Wednesday, August 29th at 1500 Universal, as we pay tribute to one of the greatest pop stars of all time.